Okay, well, I understand that the purpose of having a lunch seminar is that so that the speaker can entertain the people and increase the pleasure of having lunch. So in the good tradition of the entertainment industry, I'm going to start with a commercial. Okay, so the commercial is that the Caltech USC Center for Theoretical Physics will continue to have visiting and workshop programs, and in particular for this coming year, next academic year is going to be from October 1st to December 15th and January 14th to May 31st. So anyone interested in visiting us, please get in touch with me. Okay. Now, I think many people perhaps don't know yet what two-time physics is all about. So I probably would have to make it as simple as I can. Although what I would like to really tell you about is the latest developments, which I think is the best form of the theory. So I don't know if I will get there. If I don't, it's going to be in a paper that will come out soon. So I will start with some general remarks on what two-time physics does. And then we'll try to illustrate that by considering the simplest possible system, which would be the spinless particle moving in a word-line formalism, moving in general backgrounds. And we will see what those backgrounds are. They are gauge fields. And this will be based on a symmetry which I think is very fundamental. It is a gauge symmetry for symplectic transformations in phase space, which transform X and P type of variables into each other. And this will be a local gauge symmetry in the entire formalism. In fact, the most important thing that I want to convey is are the symmetries in the system, and the two time and everything else that follows from the gauge symmetry itself. It is not an input. Two time itself is not an input. The gauge symmetry is the input, and the rest follows from the gauge symmetry. So after going through that, I will consider the first quantization of this system, so that through the first quantization, I will move towards field theory in the usual way. And I will do that in position space, but then it is more natural in the case of two-time physics, because the symmetries are phase-space symmetries, it is much more natural to consider first quantization in non-commutative phase space, X and P space. And you will see, well, this is an old subject. It was treated in the old days by people like Wigner and Weil, Moyal, and others. And borrowing methods from them, I will review a little bit how you do first quantization and how you obtain field equations, wave function equations, in phase space. And then this would be the formalism that eventually will lead to a field theoretical formulation of two-time physics with a gauge symmetry, which is really what I want to tell you about at the end, is this non-commutative U11 symmetry. The star is a notation for non-commutative. So at the end, really, what I would like you to remember the most is the symmetries. Now, the way I started to be interested in the issue of two-time is really M-theory. For me, it started right after Strings 1995 with the realization that the extended SUSY algebra in M-theory, which is this, by now very familiar, is really a two-dimensional, has a 12-dimensional covariance. I think many people by now realize this, but I also, in talking to many other people, it turns out that still people do not quite see exactly how this is. So I want to emphasize that this 11-dimensional superalgebra really can be viewed as a 12-dimensional superalgebra with a 10,2 signature. So you can start from the 32 supercharges, and 32 spinner in 11 dimensions is also a 12-dimensional bias spinner in 10,2 dimensions. The reason for 10,2 rather than some other signature is because you have 32 real spinners, and in order to stay with 32 real spinners, you need to take the signature to be 10,2. So therefore, we have an extra time-like dimension, if you want to think of that superalgebra in this sense, and then mu, the 11-dimensional index. Together, they make the 12, and then so therefore, the left-hand side, you can see, is really a 12-dimensional, is classified under 12 dimensions. And the right-hand side, if you take the p mu with the z mu together, they make a zmn in 12 dimensions, and the z mu 1 up to mu 5 make a 6-plane, a central 6-plane in 12 dimensions. So therefore, both sides can be classified under 12 dimensions with a 10,2 signature. And for me, this was really the starting point to be interested in the idea of the possibility of two times. Since this is such a model-independent statement about N theory. So, it is possible to see this coming out from the two-time formalism that I'm going to talk about. But this was my starting point.
So
by 1995. Yeah?
Remind me, you can't have 11,1 signature because you get the wrong reality properties.
That's correct. Wrong reality properties. Right. Okay, so by now, of course, we know many other signals of two-time-like dimensions, possibility of two-time-like dimensions in M theory. So these include the F theory, S theory, which is an algebraic approach to try to realize issues of that type, which went into 13 dimensions as well. And then the ADS-CFT correspondence, which also has a comma 2 type of signature, which is important in everything that we do. So we have some...
In what sense?
Well, we will see actually precisely that in what sense. But it is there. It is a symmetry which is there, which plays a fundamental role in many things in
theory. Hmm?
Not only conformal certainly is one, but also ADS is another one which is not conformal. But we will see that there are many others as well. Yeah.
If you want to get type 2B string theory out of F theory, right, it seems that the two terms must have a uniform signature in order to have as duality exchanging these two directions. So it seems that if F theory is a 12-dimensional theory, this 11,1 signature is more natural from this point of view.
Actually, what turns out to be more natural than what you just said is to go to 13 dimensions. And in 13, and in 13 dimensions, in fact, what you have is 64 supercharges, where the 64 can be thought of in one way. There are many ways of thinking about it, but in one way of thinking about it is 32, which are ordinary supercharges, and the other 32, which are superconformal supercharges. That's one way of thinking about it. But the same 64 can be really composed in other ways, so that you can see in that both the type A as well as the type B, 32 supercharges.
Were there other arguments in F theory for signature 10,2 besides this?
No. In fact, in F theory, I don't think that anybody has written down what the superalgebra is. So it's something missing, I believe, in F theory. And I believe F theory is not really complete as it stands. Okay, so now the issue is, if we want to even begin to think about two times, can we really take it seriously? Because immediately we have to address issues of unitarity, because there will be ghosts, because there are more time-like dimensions, there will be ghosts. Causality, what happens to it? So there are some immediate problems, which of course were the main reasons for why people stopped in the past with considering more than one time. The theory is that these types of problems is what prevented people from considering more than one time. So the only way that I could imagine that this could be addressed is with a gauge symmetry. A gauge symmetry that would be capable of removing ghosts and in some way reestablish causality. So now, in search of such a gate symmetry, we tried to realize ideas of S-theory together with Kunas back in 1996. I don't have time to describe what that was, but it did lead eventually to some other related ideas, which is what I now call two-time physics, which is what I'm going to describe. So the gate symmetry, which is important in all of that, is going to be an SP2R acting on phase space. And now this gate symmetry by now has been generalized in recent work with Ray to field theory, partially. But then in the work that I'm about to publish, it turns out to be really U11, non-commutative U11, which is the way of realizing all of that stuff in a field theoretical approach.
Question.
Yeah.
When you say the gate symmetry restores causality, what does causality mean to you?
You will see in a minute. Yeah. Very short. But causality, of course, you know, you begin to ask questions, you know, what happens if you travel in the extra time-like direction, so... okay, we will see how to address that. So, so eventually, you know, the long-term message of two-time physics, I don't really know what it is yet, okay? Because it is still developing. And eventually, whether it will tell us that there is an extra time-like dimension in some sense, I think in some sense, but not in the real, usual sense. So these questions, I cannot really give you the answers because the subject is still developing. But for the time being, you can think of two-time physics, if you like, as a device to unravel and unify hidden aspects of one-time physics. And that it does. And you do get to learn a lot more about one-time physics and about some of its structures and hidden symmetries by looking at it from this other point of view. Now, the two times is not going to be an input. It is rather a result of the gauge symmetry, which is the SP2 gauge symmetry, and also related generalizations for SP2 when you begin to consider more involved systems beyond the spinless particle. Now, the extra dimension is not only one time. It involves also one space as well as one time. So that an ordinary system, which in one-time physics would be described in D dimensions, is now described by adding one extra space and one extra time, so that you have D comma 2, so D space and two times. Now, the role of the SP2 gate symmetry, in fact, is to kill the ghosts and these extra dimensions. So it kills the extra dimensions by having more gate symmetry around. And in so doing, it ensures unitarity and reestablishes causality because at the end, you do have effectively a one-time period.
Wait, so what's the action of the SP2?
I will show. Right. Now, a single two-time system ends up unifying many one-time systems. And the way that this goes around is as follows. Say we are working in the world line formalism. So we have a position xn in d comma 2 as a function of tau. There is a single tau. There is a single proper time. However, there are two time-like dimensions in space-time, in target space-time. And the reason for that we are about to see in a minute. So we, in choosing the gauge symmetry, in choosing gauges, and coming down to a unitary gauge, we have to ask which of these two times is identified with tau. And obviously there are many choices to make. And in fact, there are an infinite number of choices to make. And then, depending on how you identify tau, there is a direction in space-time which is chosen as the evolution parameter. And by fixing a gauge, you force the entire system to evolve as a function of that choice of time. So therefore, the canonical conjugate to that choice, which is a Hamiltonian, ends up having totally different expressions depending on which time gauge you choose. And therefore, you end up having all kinds of different Hamiltonians, different looping Hamiltonians, even though you are describing the same two-time system. And each one, such Hamiltonian, describes by itself an ordinary one-time system. So therefore, what you end up is some kind of holography, in that a d-dimensional system captures the entire information about the B comma 2 system. And in so doing, it ends up revealing that there are all kinds of hidden aspects in that system. For example, there are duality symmetries that would take one choice of gauge to another choice of gauge. And different one-time systems get related to each other in this way by being really holographic descriptions of the same higher dimensional system. I will give you examples of that. Now, the higher dimensional system, of course, starts with subsymmetry in deep plus two dimensions. The symmetry depends on which kind of background you're working with, but it is, whatever symmetry there is a symmetry in deep plus two dimensions. Now, that symmetry is a symmetry which commutes with the gauge transformations. And therefore, even after choosing a gauge, the system still has that symmetry. Even when you come down to the dimensions, the system still has that symmetry in the dimensions. So therefore, each one of the one-time systems end up having some hidden symmetry in deep plus two dimensions, because even though it is easier to see the symmetry in the higher dimensional system, it is harder and it remains hidden in the deep dimensional system. And as you do that, this one-time meanings of the symmetry change depending on how you choose the gauge. In particular, conformal symmetry ends up being one of those. So SOB comma 2 of conformal symmetry ends up corresponding to a particular choice of time. And then that way, you end up understanding that D comma 2, SOD comma 2, usual conformal symmetry of massless systems, can be understood as a two-time symmetry. And I will show you which gauge I'm about to show you. So then let me begin. Are there questions? Okay, so let me begin to show you the formulation. So let me consider a word line formalism in which you have x of tau and p of tau. This is a first order formalism, so x dot p. So compare, for example, massless relativistic particle, you would write it like this. So you have basically the Einbein on the word line, multiplying p squared over 2. So this, I want to think of it as a gauge field, and of course it is a gauge field. So compare to that, and now I'm going to introduce three gauge fields, not only one, but three gauge fields, A, I, J. I and J is symmetric. It's a symmetric matrix, so it's...
Could you just remind me what various indices run over M and I?
Yeah.
M is over everything.
M is space-time.
No.
Yeah, that's right. That is target space-time. And so far, we don't even have to say which particular signature. The signature will come out, as we will see, from the equations of motion. So without committing to any signature, so we just have x dot p, right?
How do you write something down without considering finding the signature?
You just write it down.
Yeah, but the minus sign.
No, there are no minus signs. It's upward indexed and lower indexed. There are no minus signs.
And then I and J range over.
I and J range 1 and 2. So
So
it's a symmetric 2 by 2 matrix coupled to a symmetric 2 by 2 QIJ. So compare that to a 1 by 1, if you like, which would have been the E. Alright? So now, I will come back to this line in a minute, but let's first look at the gauge transformations. The gauge transformations for A are just the usual gauge transformations that you would write down, where omega is the sp2, so A is in the adjoint representation, omega is the sp2 parameter, three such parameters, and that's the gauge transformation. And then the transformation for x and for p. So far, we don't know what Q is, right? So for any such Q, first you write down the gauge transformation as being derivative of Q with respect to P when you do delta X, derivative of Q with respect to X when you do delta P. And then, since we have three of them, omega ij, and the is a function, omega ij are the parameters, but they are parameters which are functions of tau. This is what I mean by local sp2 as opposed to global sp2. All right, so if you plug in these transformations into that action and ask when, under what conditions do you find invariance, you will find that the action, in fact, is symmetric, provided Qij satisfies the sp2 algebra, provided this Qij satisfies the sp2 algebra, which is explicitly written. You have a Q11, a Q12, and a Q22. So provided they satisfy this algebra, which, if you like, in some other notation, if you write as J0, J1, and J2, the three gauge, generators of sp2, it corresponds to these combinations. J0 is the compact generator, and J1 and J2 are the non-compact generators. So it corresponds to these light cone type combinations when I talk about Q11 and Q22. And Q12 is a non-compact generator. Of course, you could have written it in whatever other form you want, but the relation of these Qijs to the generators in the usual notation, it ends up being this. So now, why did I end up with this sp2? Of course, it's because I chose to have an sp2 gauge field coupled to these Qijs. Now, the local omega, you can see omega dot appears in the transformation of the A, and omega dot will also appear when you take the derivative of the transformation of the X, and then when you put the whole thing together, you will see that this action is invariant under local sp2 transformation. Now, an example of Qijs that would do this is the following. Q11, I'm writing it with little q, because little q is going to indicate that we don't have background fields so far. So Q11 is x squared, Q12 is x dot p, and Q22 is pd. Okay, now in this case, I had to introduce a background field in order to define what I mean by the dot product. So in this dot product, I have just a flat metric, but without saying yet what the signature is. Okay, so any flat metric, x squared, x dot p, and p squared. Now, more generally, it turns out that you can satisfy all of these relations not only with these, which turned out, I mean, these particular cases were the first examples I discovered in this game. And it really is where the game started. But by now, we know that we can have these cues to include all kinds of background fields. As follows, you can imagine expanding this Q as functions of P in a power series of P, and then coefficients in this power series are all functions of X. Okay, so I chose to expand not just in P, but in something called P plus A, where A is going to have the meaning of a Maxwell-type gauge field. So powers of P plus A, and then the coefficients phi are all functions of X. So provided these fields, these background fields, are such that they satisfy the sp2, the algebra, then you have a symmetry. So you have, in fact, an infinite number of background gauge fields with which you can still satisfy this gauge symmetry, provided you satisfy the sp2 algebra. So the sp2 algebra is equivalent, in some sense, to writing down some conditions, okay, some equations for the background fields. And you can solve these equations. The result of solving these equations is that what solves all these equations are gauge fields in D dimensions, not in D plus 2, but free gauge fields without any dynamics, just any gauge field you want in D dimensions will solve these equations.
By
gauge fields, thank you for telling me, it's gauge fields that will include not only Maxwell gauge field, but also gravity and also high spin gauge fields. And in a minute, I will show you.
What is the preventing?
But there's still abelian gauge field.
Abelian, yes.
And the gauge transformation is just a linear?
No, it's just not. It mixes all these gauge fields with each other. I will show you what the transformation is in a minute, so it will become clear.
Your what question? Is that comment over there, physical state?
This one, yeah, thank you. I have to start considering the equations of motion as well. So in particular, the equation of motion for the gauge field is that the Qs should vanish. So the vanishing of the Q simply means that we must have a singlet of SP2. So namely, the phase space X and P that satisfies all X and P phase space, that satisfies this equation, will correspond to the physical phase space. And that there are non-trivial solutions to these equations only and only if we have two time-like dimensions. So the signature, in fact, comes in at this point when you try to solve the equations of motion.
But you put it 3 times.
Well, okay. How do you see your
objective? Okay, I will, by taking this particular example, let's just see in this particular example. We have to say that x squared, remember we didn't know the signature up to that point. So it says that we need to have a vector x and a vector p that are both light-like, as well as perpendicular to each other. Now, if the signature were Euclidean, the solution is zero. If the signature has one time, it is trivial because they have to be parallel and there will be no angular momentum. If the signature is two, there are solutions, or three or four and so on.
What's wrong with the pair?
With what?
Yeah.
What's wrong with what?
Momentum, what goes wrong with that?
With what?
If there's one time and they're therefore parallel, what is the problem?
It is a solution, but it is a too simple of a system. There is no angular momentum.
So
fine. I mean, it's just a trivial system. That's okay. I mean, what are you going to describe with that? So it's just a trivial system. I mean, I'm not saying that there is no solution. It's just a trivial system.
In what sense trivial?
Well, but you have an x and a p that have to be parallel. So what satisfies that? I mean, what non-trivial system satisfies that? It's just a trivial system.
So cannot you have more than two time coordinates, say 20?
Yeah, I'm about to say that. Okay, so if you have two or more, then you can have non-trivial solutions. However, if you have more than two, then you have ghosts in the theory. There will be unitarity and causality problems in the theory. And the only case for which you can solve all of these problems is exactly two.
But if Q are not having higher power in polynomial, you can easily satisfy it.
It's not so clear that it is so easy. You have to solve all these other conditions also. It's not so clear. So let's start with this.
Yeah, but
you're
not, I do claim that there is no...
That's what I think. I mean, I'm about to solve all of the conditions, and then you can see.
There is no non-trivial higher polynomial solutions to those constraints.
I believe so.
Which has no non-trivial solutions.
I believe so. But I will take you as far as I can go with that, and then beyond that, if you can find a solution, fine. I mean, I will just be happy. But I believe that this is it. Remember, you have to satisfy.
Do you think that exactly a unique solution to those equations?
Two times, I think so. Without ghosts, okay? Without ghosts, without unitarity or causality problems, I believe it is the only one. Certainly to this, but that's also I believe to the more general. I will tell you what is the solution before you jump to other issues.
You're saying that this quadratic form is the only way of constructing generators of SP2.
No. As I said, you can have a general function expanded in powers of P, but this expansion, the coefficients of this expansion, the fields as functions of X, must satisfy also this algebra. This is an equation that imposed on these fields.
Yeah.
I will show you what these equations are.
If those solutions exist, then so those are higher polynomial, and then you can solve this equation even generically.
Well, you will see in a minute. Okay, you will see in a minute.
Even
you will see in a minute. Okay. You haven't seen it.
But anyway, that statement that you made there is a conjecture.
Which one? Let's wait and see, okay? Let's wait and see. First, let me tell you what are all these QIJs, okay, that satisfy these equations. Now, before I solve them, let me notice one more thing about this. One more symmetry which would be important. Okay, so far I told you about the local SP2 symmetry, but one more symmetry which is important, which is the kind of symmetry that make transformations, gauge transformations, on the background fields. So, such as, you know, when you have a background field coupled to a particle, a mu, you have some gauge symmetry. Or if you have a gravitational background, say in string theory, you allow yourself to transform them also with general coordinate transformations. That's because you have in mind, in the back of your mind, that you have a theory, some kind of field theory, that has those symmetries. And then with those symmetries, you imagine that you can make some transformations on your background fields. So what is the analog of that here? And then I will use that symmetry, which will be important eventually when I also construct the field theory at the end. So the largest symmetry you can imagine is the symmetry of this first term, before I even say anything about that. And that is all possible canonical transformations. So all possible canonical transformations, such that infinitesimally, delta x is this and delta p is this. Notice what is different between the previous transparency and this one is that there is no time dependence, no tau dependence here. Any dependence on tau comes only through x and p, whereas previously there was that omega ij, which was tau dependent. So now this first term is invariant under all possible canonical transformations. Now, if I make such canonical transformations on my action, so change x and p on the canonical transformation, the q goes to a new q, which means that the fields are being transformed into a new set of fields. So the action, of course, is not invariant. Only that first term is invariant. The action is not invariant because q of x tilde and p tilde is a new q of x's and p's. However, because these are canonical transformations, remember the condition on the Q was that it should satisfy the SP2 algebra. So because these are canonical transformations, if Q to start with satisfies the SP2 algebra, Q tilde also will. So if I want to look for all possible solutions of this theory, all possible Qs, so I can look in the space of all theories. The space of all theories that are related to each other by canonical transformations.
This is our way to construct a new solution, but it's not clear whether this exhausts all the solutions.
No. It's not clear. But if I have any solution, I will find new solutions by applying canonical transformations.
It is equivalent to claiming that if you have any solution to the previous equation,
right.
The previous transformation,
I will find new ones.
You can do the canonical transformation to bring it into bilinear form.
No.
That's equivalent statement.
If I start from the bilinear form.
No, I'm saying that if this statement, this exhausts all the solutions, it's equivalent to saying that any solution to the previous equation can be mapped into the bilinear solution by canonical transformation.
I will tell you what it maps into. I'm saying if you have any kind of solution, you will find new solutions by applying canonical transformations. That's what I said so far. I did not say what you said. Okay? So now let me say what you can do with this. First of all, you can make Q11. You can make it x squared. Okay, so start from any general function that Q11 was.
Also make it x.
You can also make it x.
But which x? That's got a free index.
One of the x's. That's okay.
Well, yeah, you can.
One of the x's. But I prefer to write it in this form. Okay. I prefer to define an x such that when I make my transformations on q, like that I call it x squared. Okay. Now, then it turns out that there is remaining canonical symmetry. Now, with this remaining canonical symmetry, you analyze the equations that must be satisfied and see what else you can do with the remaining canonical symmetry. Now, provided Q tilde 1, 2 also satisfies the canonic, the SP2 algebra, then you can make Q 1, 2 also extractly. And that's about it. There is remaining symmetry, but it's not sufficient to make Q tilde whatever you want, Q tilde Q2 whatever you want. So this is a general function of X and P. So now this general function of X and P, you can write it out, as I said before. So it's a general polynomial of P. So you have now defined background fields that are G0, no indices, AM, which was this Maxwell field, G2, with two indices, which will play a role, precisely the role of a metric, and then GS with S indices, which are symmetric, which will play the role of gauge fields for high spin. Now, if you then satisfy, and then if you look at what is the condition on these fields for them to satisfy the SP2 algebra, it turns out they all must be perpendicular to X. Okay, they all must be perpendicular to X, and they all must be homogeneous with a given degree. So, for example, let me start from the Maxwell field. It has to be perpendicular to A, and A must be homogeneous of degree minus one, which is like momentum would be, exactly the dimension of the momentum. Then G2. Remember, in order to define x squared, I had to introduce a background field. So with this background field, then G2 has to have the background field plus any function of x, such that that function is perpendicular to x, and it is homogeneous of degree exactly minus 2. So, zero. And then the others, again, must be perpendicular to X and must be homogeneous with degree S minus 2. So provided you satisfy these equations, then you are satisfying, you are solving the most general SP2. All right, so now the conditions that these must vanish, okay? So the equations of motion were that all the Qs must vanish. So it says that x squared is 0, x squared is 0, and then this is a more general thing. All right, so I leave it up to you to say whether this requires two times or less.
No, you didn't give a general solution.
Okay. If I missed something, I'd like to know what I missed.
You didn't show me how to construct a general solution, so...
This is up to canonical transformations.
The general solution can be put in this form, and then you have to find G.
Right. But you didn't show why this is true.
He's arguing that given any solution, you can find a canonical transformation that will take Q11 and Q12 to that form.
Right.
But,
is that obvious?
By a canonical.
Well, as I said, I have a paper to read it, of course. But so the first point starts by making this general function Q11, whatever it was, make it x squared. The second point is that there is remaining gauge symmetry. You use the gauge symmetry plus the equation that you must satisfy.
Remaining gauge symmetry.
All right.
Remaining canonical transformation.
So it is that delta Q11 tilde must be 0.
Yeah.
And the canonical transformation on the Qij, all of them, is that Poisson bracket of omega 0 of x and p commuted with the Qij. So this is the transformation rule that allowed you, this is the infinitesimal transformation rule. So you want delta Q11 to be 0. So therefore, that means that the omega 0 with x squared must vanish. So then you can write omega 0 as a power series. Okay, so m1 up to ms, p m1 up to p ms, and then commute it with x squared, and you will see that x dotted into this epsilon s must be 0. As long as you satisfy that, all the epsilons that are perpendicular to x is the remaining canonical symmetry.
And
And that.
So you can use that.
That's general enough to fix Q12.
Not by itself. As long as Q12 also satisfies the algebra.
Then this symmetry is enough.
Then this symmetry is enough to make Q12. So hopefully I didn't miss something, but if I did miss, it only means that there is something slightly more general.
At the end, very end, so you're claiming these equations only have the solution G mu for theta, G2 non-vanishing, the rest have to vanish?
No. I can solve these equations easily. It's no problem solving. I mean, it only says that they are perpendicular to X and that they are homogeneous. It's very easy to solve them.
Right.
You only need to choose some parameterization for the X's and then solve it. It's very easy to solve. It's no problem.
Why is Q22 equals P squared monster? The only solution.
Why is Q22? No, I didn't say. This is the general one. As long as this field satisfies.
P squared is all those back fields hash.
Okay. Now, for this general solution, why doesn't it work with one time?
I'm not necessarily claiming it. Let me leave it as an open issue. But you still have to set n equal to zero and solve.
Yeah, but then
X has to be like an orthogonal to P and G X like
something more general. But this is an interacting theory now. It's no longer. I mean, you have a P which is interacting, and that P is such that it must satisfy this function equal to zero. It's not going to be P squared equal to zero, obviously.
Yep.
But it is an interacting particle with interactions.
Well, why does that require two times?
Let me leave that open. Okay, let me not push that point. Okay, maybe there are some other solutions. It is so general. You know, I'm not going to claim necessarily that it requires two times.
Okay.
But certainly the free particle requires two times, and then you can go from there, analyze it perturbatively if you like. Okay. Now, these remaining equations, I can solve them. I don't know, I'm running out of time because I really want to get to the essential points. But one thing I should mention about this remaining, that there is further remaining symmetry, as I say, after those two gauge choices for Q11 and Q22, there still is remaining gauge symmetry, but insufficient to remove all these remaining gauge fields. But then you can ask, what is it? Okay, so what it is an omega of this type which commutes both with x squared and x dot p, so that Q11 and Q12 do not change, okay, under the remaining gauge symmetry. So those are epsilons like that which satisfy this equation. So epsilons that are homogeneous of a certain degree depending on the spin and then perpendicular to x. And so the gauge transformations on the remaining objects, on the remaining fields, are exactly the gauge transformations that you would expect for various types of gauge fields. In particular, the Maxwell field transforms with the epsilon zero over there. The metric transforms with the epsilon 1, which is general reparametrizations. And then the highest spin fields transform in this way. And then there are nonlinear terms all over the place. Okay, so
that. Something is bothering me about your approach, because I mean, you're discussing so far classical theory.
Yeah.
And you're making heavy use out of canonical transformations,
right,
which are not quite transformations.
Right.
The ones we know can never be implemented in quantum
mechanics. Very good. So I will come to quantum mechanics. Yeah, it's a very good thing to look at. And I have looked at it, and I will tell you. Okay, so I'm about...
Are you going to look at it for anything aside from integrable systems?
Oh, gosh, I mean,
one case
look, I have not solved the entire world yet, okay?
No.
So I'm making slow progress here.
but you realize the enormous danger of playing this game, because the transformations you're considering, they're quite wrong, ones that mix X's and P's, are exactly the ones where you can never be implemented in quantum mechanics, and
Never, never is too strong.
Except for integrable systems.
Never is, okay, except for.
Any quantum mechanical system could be reduced to, you know, to a free system or to
sure,
a harmonic oscillator by canonical transformation.
Sure, David, look, I have not solved, I have not solved everything. I have solved a certain amount.
Well, but if you're going to now turn around and say, okay, this is okay quantum mechanically because I'm going to look at a simple harmonic oscillator and show us that it works there, you're avoiding the issue.
Oh, I don't wish to avoid the issue. I'm only able to do certain things and not everything. So, I mean, obviously I'm going to leave open a bunch of things and you know, we can talk about it and investigate.
This issue?
Am I going to what?
For the issue of whether this can survive quantum mechanics.
Yeah. I'm about
or anything but an integrable system?
No, because what I have done are simple things. I can only
you
do
don't have the problem.
David, I can only do simple things. But when you do it for quantum mechanics, you will learn new things. So that much I promise. Okay. More than the classical theory. That much I promise. So let me, in fact, before I go on, still with the classical theory, just give you some examples of what happens now when you begin to consider a system like that. So let me take the simplest case, okay? So the free case, no background fields, just x squared, x times p, and p squared. Now, by making gate choices, I claim that this system reduces to any one of these things that I'm writing over here. So the massless relativistic particle in D dimensions. Here we started with D plus 2. The D plus 2 we are committed to because we cannot solve the system otherwise. So now the massless relativistic particle in D dimensions. The massive relativistic particle in D dimensions, not only the massless. The massive non-relativistic particle also in D dimensions, including time. The particle in an LDS background as well as LDS plus S background, provided the total number of the dimension is still the same as the others. The hydrogen atom and some generalizations of it, also in the total number of the dimensions. The harmonic oscillator in one less dimension, when you consider the mass parameter as an additional dimension, so then the total is the same. And then some particles in some other potential, such as black holes, but those cases are for special cases, such as only in total three dimensions. So I claim that this system reduces to any one of these by gauge fixing. And so this is perhaps what is really, really new in doing two-time physics. In unifying totally different looking Hamiltonians as being the same as coming from the same higher dimensional system in D plus 2.
By canonical transformation.
By the SP2, by using the SP2 symmetry. Okay, remember I had two things. One that related those to more general functions, and then the other one was the local SP2.
But if you tried to do it within the framework of this system, it would be involved.
If I want, say it again, if I...
I mean, I can take a quantum mechanical system describing a harmonic oscillator, one described with hydrogen atoms, and transform one into another.
Yes.
And that's what you're essentially saying.
I'm saying...
The answer to Hiroshi is that it's by tau-dependent canonical transformation.
Right, by tau-dependent canonical transformation. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. You can relate it as long as you use tau.
Normally, we don't. You know. So normally, would you say that ordinary quantum mechanics exhibits enormous holography? Because classically, you could map by if you allow yourself to do this a harmonic oscillator onto the hydrogen atom. And if you were naive, you'd then say the spectrum of one is mapped to the spectrum of the other. True. And
I don't say it is true because
so what does holography mean?
Okay. Let me go on and tell you what holography means. It means that they can all be expressed like that. And I know the key for how to relate one to the other. In particular, symmetries. Okay? I claim the actions of all these guys have SOD canonical symmetry. Each one of them has SOD canonical symmetry. Some of them will surprise you, such as the massless non-relativistic particle having SOD canonical symmetry. The particle in a DS background You know it has an SOD minus 1 Kramatorp symmetry. I claim it has an even bigger symmetry, not just SOD minus 1 Kramatorp, but SOD Kramatorp symmetry. Those are hidden symmetries which you didn't know about before. The hydrogen atom has an SOD Kramatorp symmetry. Of course, you knew about the massless relativistic particle, but you didn't know about the massive relativistic particle having such symmetry, or you didn't know the harmonic oscillator having such symmetries. Now, when I go to the quantum mechanics, it will be even more surprising how these symmetries actually tell you some very strong statements, duality statements, about the systems. So I claim you are learning more by looking at the world, at the one-time world, from this point of view. Okay, now first quantization. So you can approach the issue of first quantization either through covariant quantization, which would mean applying the constraints on the states and then looking for physical states, or by first choosing gauges and then solving the constraints and then eventually quantizing the remaining degrees of freedom. You can approach it either way. Now, the one which is, of course, the most symmetric is that one. So let me first mention that one. So for the free particle, so when the q's were just x squared, x times p, and p squared, we want these equations to be satisfied. Now, this one says that phi must be a delta function times some other function. This one, after you take care of the delta function, this f then must be homogeneous of a particular degree. This d is coming because of this permission way of writing things. And then that one, which is the D'Alembertian, can be written as the radial part plus the angular momentum part. The radial part is determined because this is the radial operator. And then the angular momentum part tells you that this function f must satisfy this equation. So this says that x and d derivative, of course, is angular momentum in it's the SOD comma 2. Okay, so this is the SOD comma 2 generator, must have a very definite eigenvalue on such functions. And as it turns out, this is the singleton representation, which is unitary, provided you have SOD comma 2, not some other signature. Now, furthermore, these equations would be trivial. There would be no content if you had a Euclidean signature or if you had one-time signature. So it's the same thing that we saw in the classical theory. Now, to solve these equations explicitly, you can take a particular parametrization. Taking a particular parametrization is parallel, very parallel, to choosing gauges in coming down from d plus 2 dimensions to d dimensions. So you can come down in many different ways. So as you come down in this particular way, you will find that this f of x, in terms of these variables, well, little x mu is d dimensions, x plus prime and x minus prime are the extra dimensions. They are like compact extra dimensions. So that this f of x is homogeneous in the x plus prime variable, and it is an arbitrary function of x mu and that ratio. But in order to satisfy the x squared equal to zero condition, then x minus has to be set equal to zero after you apply whatever derivatives you need to apply. So at the end, this psi of x satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation in d dimensions. So this, in fact, was discovered by Dirac back in 1936. So Dirac was trying to understand SOD comma 2, the conformal symmetry, SO4 comma 2 in his case. He was trying to understand it in a more linearized way. Okay, so he was unhappy about the nonlinear nature of conformal transformations, and he wanted to understand it in a more linear way. In fact, he wrote down these equations, precisely these equations, and showed that you can come down from these d plus two-dimensional equations to d dimensions, and that these equations are just equivalent to the Klein-Gordon equation in d dimensions. So this explains why you have conformal symmetry, that you can understand conformal symmetry, if you like, linearly, as a linearly realized symmetry, provided you have two more dimensions. Now, this can be generalized. The equations that I showed you before for the Maxwell field, for the gravitational field, for the high spin fields, all of them. So they are the equivalent, if you like, of these equations, plus the condition that I have to apply, also x squared and x dot p. Plus the zero conditions. So if you take those equations, all those gauge fields that I mentioned before that were in D plus two dimensions, they all get reduced to fields in D dimensions. And so they become, in fact, the gauge fields in D dimensions. And you can understand all of that in a field theoretic language. So if you like, through this language, you have resolved the issues of ordering problems in the quantum theory, because you're starting completely covariant. Now, you can also do it by choosing a gauge from the start. Choosing a gauge from the start would be setting things like that, x plus or x minus, to certain values to start with by choosing gauges. And then you have fewer variables, then you can quantize those fewer variables, and then get into the issues of ordering them correctly, so that at the end, you still are in this representation. So all the systems that I mentioned before, hydrogen atom and all the others, they are all in the same representations. They all have the same Casimir. So this is one thing you learn: duality relations. Quantities that you can compute in one theory can be computed also in another theory. And you know precisely the map, how to go from one theory to the other. And you can compute anything which is gauge invariant in one theory or in another theory, and you will be guaranteed to find the same values. So in particular, Casimirs are the same.
So what about spectra, for example?
Spectra are not gauge invariant. Spectra are not gauge invariant. What are gauge invariant, okay, what are gauge invariant are, in the flat theory, are these quantities, which are xm, pm, the original xm, pm, anti-symmetric.
No.
And for example, take dualities in M theory. You go to different corners of M theory, the spectra are not the same. The law.
Okay, well, you're changing the physical parameter.
Yeah.
But say if you're telling us that, say, a free particle and the hydrogen atom and all these other things are dual to one another, I don't see what the free parameter is that you're adjusting.
Well, in this case, I'm looking, of course, at very simple systems. I don't have background fields. With background fields, there will be things to adjust. But for this very simple system, there still are all these relations. Any function of element is gauge invariant, whatever function you want. So you can compute this in any form of the theory, and you are guaranteed to find the same. Say if it is correlation functions, in this case I computed element squared, right, the Casimir. That happens to be a number. It's not anything complicated. So
does that commute with the Hamiltonian? Does that commute with the Hamiltonian in any of these systems?
No, Hamiltonian is a function of the element, so it's not going to commute.
Right. So
in conformal symmetry, you know, these are the conformal generators.
I can't say label states. Okay. Inconvenient to label states, but
exactly. So let me in fact clarify that. Thank you for bringing up the point. The states are going to be labeled by SO D comma 2 by the various Casimirs. So as many Casimirs as it takes. Then additional operators that commute with the Casimirs. So the Casimirs are all the same because they are numbers. So in any version, in any gauge fixed version, they are all the same. The other operators that you choose to diagonalize, such as Hamiltonian, it's only defining a basis for the particular representation. So these are not the gauge invariants. These guys are the gauge invariants. But you remain within the same representation.
The whether you're the Casimirs.
The Hamiltonian communes with the Casimirs. Such as in the hydrogen atom. Or for the conformal particle, for the massless particle. And maybe I should have mentioned, in the case of B equals 4, just to emphasize that there are numbers around. Okay, so if you compute the quadratic Casimir it will end up being that in terms of the lower number of dimensions. So for b equals 4, it is minus 3. So this indeed, if you look at the cousinness for the conformal transformations in field theory, it's exactly, this is the cousinness for that, for the conformal transformations for the Klein-Gordon particle. If you look at the ones for the hydrogen atom, which are well known, you compute it is minus 3. If you do it for the ADS, it is minus 3. But for ADS, as I said, most people consider SOD minus 1, comma 2, don't go as far as SOD, comma 2. But there is an SOD, comma 2, explicitly written in some of my papers. And then for that, for the complete one, the cousinate is minus 3 if you are in four dimensions. So there are numbers, if you like, they are experimental numbers in some sense that you can compare to verify that there are such degrees. Any questions? How much more time do I have?
Not how much time do you have?
Unfortunately.
Well,
at least I want to be able to tell you about the field theory. The non-commutative field theory. Let me go very quickly because there were many questions, so I couldn't go as fast as I had imagined that I could. But anyway, so the non-commutative field theory arises as follows. I just showed you quantization, first quantization in X space. But first quantizations can also be done in phase space. And then with Ray in a recent paper, we showed that the correct way of doing it is that we define the Weierstrass product, the usual Weierstrass product in phase space, and then that Q applied on a function of X, on a wave function of X space using the Weierstrass product equal to zero is the condition for physical states, and that these Qs satisfy the SP2 algebra. Remember, the SP2 algebra, the Qs, is what describes gauge fields, and then this describes a matter field. Now, the question is, what is the non-commutative field theory that gives these as equations of motion? So this is the analog, if you like, of having the Virasoro conditions versus having a field theory. Okay, so what is the analog of writing down a field theory that gives you the constraints equal to zero? Now, we could have attempted that in X space rather than phase space. However, the symmetries that are important here are really phase space symmetries. And so it is unnatural to try to realize them in a very awkward way in X space. And it is a lot more natural to try to realize those gauge symmetries in phase space. So let me skip quite and tell you really what these symmetries should be and are. So we start out by defining star products between fields. So by X, I mean both X and P. And if I were to make a global transformation under SP2, you can make it by using QIJ, star product, as an infinitesimal generator. Now, this is if you were doing a scalar field. And if I'm doing, say, a doublet field, then I will need not only that term, but also an additional term which also transforms the index. So now, in going from global transformations under SP2 to local transformations, I need to change the omega into a local function of x1 and x2, where these are non-commutative. So then, for example, a transformation such as this, omega ij qij, becomes, the whole thing becomes a function of x like that, omega 0, where omega 0 is the star product of the omega ij with the qij. So therefore, a local SP2 transformation on a scalar will look like a phase transformation, a non-commutative phase transformation in non-commutative field theory. Now, on the other hand, if I'm doing a doublet, I will have a local omega k, L, as well as an omega 0 coming from these different places. Now, if you try to close such transformations with each other, you will find that you cannot have separately local SP2 and separately this omega 0, which was like a U1. Because closure in non-commutative phase space requires that two such transformations close into one such transformation. So therefore, the whole thing altogether becomes an abelian, and it becomes U11 gauge symmetry. So therefore, this U11 gauge symmetry can be thought of as a 2x2 matrix being applied on a doublet, which has a symmetric part, which is what I was trying to talk to as being SP2, and then an anti-symmetric part, which is this omega 0, that has to do with the phase transformation. So a doublet would transform like that, with a star product. So if I want to do all of this in field theory, I need to have a U11. So unfortunately, I have to skip a lot. And then introduce gauge fields in the adjunct representation. I can call it J, which is again a similar matrix to the omega I introduced before. But transformation loss for J is this. Introduce matter as being a 1/2-1/2 representation, where you have a left side and the right side, so therefore a U11 cross a U11, left and right. And then finally write an invariant action, which is what would be the analog of a field theory. Now, as it turns out, in the gauge fields, this is like a Chern-Simons theory. In the gauge fields, it goes up to JQ, and then you can allow anything in lower powers in J, and you can show that up to field reparameterizations, field redefinitions, this is the only form, this is the unique form that you can write down for the gauge theory, which is consistent with the gauge symmetries. So now I claim that the equations of motion of this theory reproduce everything that I said before about the first quantized version of the theory. I'm sorry, but since I don't have time, I will not be able to show you, really. But it does. Okay, let me just say that it does. And furthermore, the way it does it, the equations that you get are nonlinear, but the way it does it is by extending these J's in a power series, in a perturbative series, such that the zeroth order term involves the Q that I mentioned before. And the higher order terms are gauge field fluctuations around those background gauge fields that I mentioned before. So you have background gauge fields, which satisfy everything that I said before about the world line theory, and then fluctuations, which correspond to the fluctuations that will satisfy around the background, say the flat background, the gauge fields that we would call photons or gravitons and so on. And then you can show that these first order fluctuations satisfy the correct kind of equations of motion, Klein-Gordon type equations of motion, as they follow from this field theory. I believe that this probably will resolve a long-standing problem having to do with high-spin gauge fields. So this is still under investigation. So let me finish here. Although I didn't have much time, I want to claim that the U11 gauge principle in a phase space field theory unifies many X-space gauge principles, in particular the Maxwell, Einstein, and Heisman gauge principles, become encapsulated in one gauge transformation. We call this U11. Through the D plus 2 point of view, you end up learning about some holographic aspects going from D plus 2 to D. And you also learn about some hidden symmetries in the dimensions, and also learn that there are certain duality relations that you can investigate. The types of things that I investigated so far are mostly for the free field case. Now, you can generalize all of this, and some of this has been done, to spinning particles. So that requires that the SP2 becomes an OSP n/2 on the world line. And in the non-commutative field theory, it's a conjecture that what you will need is a U1 star, a non-commutative U11/n. it has been also generalized to space-time supersymmetry, and superparticles in B equals 3, 4, 5, and 6 have been understood in this language. The ADS process, Kaluza-Klein tower, has been understood also in this language as a word line theory. And also there is a toy model which shows that the global symmetry, supersymmetry, OSP 1/64, which includes deep brain effects, can give you, by making these gate choices, these various types of gate choices, can give you the types of supersymmetries that you see in M-theory, such as type A, type B, the type of question that you asked earlier in the early part of the talk. Can be explicitly seen in a toy and model, that by choosing gauges starting in 13, this is a global supersymmetry in 13 dimensions. By starting from that you can actually reach various corners of M theory by making gauge choices. Now, strings and brains, there is only partial progress so far. In particular, tensionless strings and brains have been formulated in a two-time language, but tensionful ones still remain to be analyzed. It's been kind of difficult. And then matrix models has been also a target, but this latest thing, this U11 field theory, can be also reformulated, can also be seen as being a large N matrix model for a UN, N. So you can rewrite, although it went very fast, you can rewrite those field theory equations as the large N matrix model for such N matrix. So I'll stop there.
More questions?
I think we're all asked to do time, so thank you again.